Lectures on the Establishment and Extension of National Churches by Thomas Chalmers. Delivered in London from April 25th to May 12th, 1838. Note: some references and citations were passed over for greater ease of listening. The listener is referred to the original to access them. Lecture 2. Vindication of a Religious National Establishment in Opposition to the Reasonings and Views of the Economists. Before entering on the positive and direct argument in favor of a national establishment of religion, I endeavored in my last lecture to do away this initial objection, or rather this initial prejudice against it, as if the connection between church and state, which is implied by it, implied also a secularization of Christianity, to which it is not equally exposed under all other methods either for extending or maintaining the gospel in the world. In these days of fierce partisanship, we cannot expect much of cool and clear discrimination. When men are borne along as if by a sort of gregarious impulse and under the influence of a popular and prevailing cry. In Edinburgh, a few years ago, at one of those public meetings, where the connection between church and state is no sooner spoken of than it lights up an instant and sensitive antipathy in the hearts of assembled thousands, there was a speech delivered by an American clergyman of the Presbyterian denomination who happened to be an acquaintance of my own. The multitude whom he addressed were every one of them enraptured at hearing from his lips that the idea of any such connection was held in perfect abomination all over America. I afterwards ventured to make the whole controversy a subject of conversation with him, and my first question was whether, if a Christian philanthropist, seized with a strong affection for a district in Maryland, were to bequeath £10,000 for the erection of a church and ministerial dwelling place, and for the maintenance of a clergyman, providing at the same time that this clergyman should be of the Presbyterian denomination, and that, in things ecclesiastical, he should be wholly under the control of his own Presbyterian judicatories in America, whether such an endowment would be rejected by their General Assembly or Supreme Court of Management as an unscriptural and unchristian thing, or be accepted by the body as an accession to the means of religious usefulness. There could be but one answer to this question, which was that an endowment thus destined and thus placed under the guardianship of what he deemed to be a pure scriptural church would be welcomed and encouraged to the uttermost. I then asked whether, if these endowments were so multiplied as that the whole state of Maryland should be covered with them, still adhering to the supposition that the theology of all these Maryland clergymen was in no subordination whatever to the will of the testators, but only to the will of their ecclesiastical superiors, the presbyteries and synods and General Assembly of America? Whether such an arrangement, admitted by him to be desirable and good in reference to one small territory, whether the character and effect would be at all changed if the benefit of it were multiplied several hundred times and spread over the whole of Maryland. It, of course, was most readily admitted that just as one apple, multiplied by 750, does not land you in 750 oranges, but in 750 apples, so one moral and religious benefit, multiplied by the same number, does not land in 750 evils, but in 750 most unquestionable and most desirable benefits. After this, the transition was not a difficult one from the single state of Maryland to the whole United States of America. And then the only adjustment betwixt us which remained to be made was whether such a great and general endowment that would have so delighted all their hearts, if coming from the hands of so many thousand generous individuals, whether, if it had come down to them as the fruit of an endowment that had been instituted many hundred years ago, and was therefore so firmly based on a separate and proprietary right of its own, that no one individual could honestly affirm of himself that he was injured by its existence in anything that belonged to him, whether, as he and his brethren would rejoice in the coming on of such an endowment, whether they would willingly consent to the taking of it off at the clamorous outcry of men who represented it, not only as a bane and a burden on the commonwealth, but as an unchristian abomination in the midst of their land. The rejoinder upon this was a very memorable one. If all you mean by an establishment is an organized provision for a clergy, we should rejoice in it. If this be the whole amount of the connection between church and state, if maintenance and nothing else come from one quarter, and an unfettered theology from the other, without contamination from the authority of man, but subject only to an ecclesiastical judgment, grounded upon a principle of deference to the Word of God, a simple arrangement of this sort is truly a different thing from what we understand by a religious establishment. The thing we deprecate is the authority of the civil magistrate in matters of religion, but we should be thankful to him or to anyone else for giving us what he termed an organized provision for clergymen. Now, this organized provision is truly all that we contend for. It is just, in other words, a legal provision for the support of a Christian ministry, an arrangement which might truly be gone into, and which actually is gone into, without the slightest infringement on the spiritual prerogatives of the Church, or on the ecclesiastical independence of her clergymen. It is obvious from all this that the indignation of our transatlantic friend was directed against a wrong object, and that he failed in making the requisite distinction between the act of a government in giving food and raiment to ministers, and the act of a government in assuming a lordship over the creed and consciences of ministers. But it is not amid the din and uproar of public acclamations that men can be expected to distinguish very clearly between the things which differ. When an orator denounces the connection between church and state, the effect is instantaneous on all those who, without logic and without discrimination, are carried along by the deafening outcries, and no less deafening plaudits, of an assembly, amid the noise and excitement of which the still small voice of truth is overborne. But we must now pass on to the proper subject of this lecture, which is the vindication of a religious national establishment in opposition to the reasonings and views of the economists. By the system of a free trade in commerce, its various exchanges are left to the pure operation of demand and supply. And the two, it is thought, should be permitted, without interference, to regulate and to qualify each other. When the demand for any particular commodity increases, it will be the interest of the dealers to provide it in larger quantity than before. Or, when the demand is lessened, it will be their care to reduce the supply accordingly, so as that the market shall not be overstocked with any article beyond the extent to which it is sought after. It admits, we hold, of the clearest demonstration that it is unwise to interfere with this law of action and reaction, or, as it may be termed, with this natural law of political economy. The supply rises and falls just as the demand rises and falls. Government should make no attempt to restrain the supply beneath this point by means of a prohibition, or to encourage it above this point by means of a bounty. Such an interference is an offense to all wise and enlightened economists, and resented by them as a disturbing force that would violate the harmonies of a beautiful and well-going mechanism. This prepares us to understand what is meant by the system of a free trade in Christianity. Under its hands, the article of religious instruction is left to the same treatment and to the operation of the same laws with an article of ordinary merchandise, according to which Christian instruction should be provided for a community to a greater or less degree, just as there is a demand for it. Or, in other words, is left to be regulated by the laws and, of course, to be limited by the extent of the market. At this rate, the supply, whether as respects its amount upon the whole or the proportion of it in various places, will be made to suit the taste of the customers. It will betake itself to those places where there is what economists term an effective demand for it, that is, where there is wealth enough and will enough to ensure a remunerating price for the expense of its preparation. A free trade in commerce only seeks to those places where it can make out a gainful trade. But it is sure to avoid or to abandon those places where, whether from the languor of the demand or the poverty of the inhabitants, it would be exposed to a losing trade. By a free trade in Christianity, let the lessons of the gospel follow the same law of movement, and these lessons will cease to be taught in every place where there is either not enough of liking for the thing, or not enough of money for the purchase of it, or that religion, the great and primary characteristic of which was that it should be preached unto the poor, must be withheld from those people who are unable by poverty to provide a maintenance for its teachers. And the teachers of this religion, whose office it is, after the example of its great founder, to seek and to save those who are lost, must make no attempt to awaken from their slumbers those who have no value and will therefore give no price for their ministrations, because lost in the apathy of a deep and settled unconcern and sunk in the indifference of spiritual death. This brief and bare statement, one might think, of the effects of a free trade in Christianity should be enough to condemn a system which seems to carry its own signal refutation along with it. But we ought to understand what the precise distinction is between commerce and Christianity, which calls for such a difference of treatment between the two as that for which we are contending, so that while the one prospers to the uttermost under the system of free trade and reaches by its means the greatest possible diffusion of its blessings and benefits through the world, the other, under the same system, would shrink into narrower dimensions and be limited to a small fraction of the human species. If there be a diversity in the two cases, there must be a reason for it, which admits of being distinctly stated, and which may be distinctly apprehended. When Turgot and Smith and others proposed to assimilate the one to the other, so as to leave them both to the pure operation of demand and supply, and without the artificial encouragement, whether of bounties or endowments, if there be error in the proposition of these economists, they must have been misled by the light of some false analogy, which surely is capable of being exposed. In other words, there must be some intelligible principle, capable of being propounded and put into language, and on which the system of free trade, so applicable to the one case, is not alike applicable to the other also. The following, then, is our explanation. Generally speaking, there is, by the very constitution of our nature, a sufficient intensity of desire and consequently of demand for the articles which commerce deals in, and so as to call forth an adequate supply of these articles, or a supply commensurate to all the exigencies of human society. There is no such intensity of desire or of demand for the article of Christian instruction. When it is affirmed, in regard to the goods of ordinary merchandise, that they might, with all safety, be left to the operation of demand and supply, it is always presupposed of the one element that it is sufficiently strong to stimulate and call forth the other. And so it usually is. The longer a man is in want of food, the keener will become his appetency of hunger, till at length he would give any price or make any sacrifice in order to obtain it. And so it is of other sensations, which impel him to seek after other necessaries of existence, as the cold which makes it indispensable to his comfort that he should be clothed and lodged as well as fed. Even when the necessaries of life are refined into exquisite and high-wrought luxuries, there is a sufficiently spontaneous and widespread desire after these to ensure a sufficient demand for them, in the physical sense of taste and the vanity of man, or his natural love of distinction, the one disposing him to the gratifications of the table, the other, though at the expense of all he can give away, to the decorations of his person and equipage and household establishment. Man's natural liking for these things affords a powerful enough guarantee, either for that part of his labor which he is willing to put forth, or for that part of his wealth which he is willing to give up in order to acquire them. Between the love of gain on the one hand and the love of enjoyment on the other, there is no danger but the wheels of commerce will move with velocity enough, and in the very direction, too, that is most suited both for the needs of customers and the prosperity of dealers. It seeks no other aid at the hands of the legislature than the enforcement of justice between man and man. The bounties wherewith a misjudging government would seek to encourage it, but serve to displace or to embarrass its movements, which, by the voice of all experience and all philosophy, might be left with the utmost safety and the best possible advantage to a self-going mechanism of its own. Now, the very reverse of all this holds of Christianity, or rather of Christian instruction, viewed as an article which is beneficial to man, and which should therefore be distributed to all the extent that is good or desirable to mankind throughout the mass of society. It is not with man's intellectual or his moral as it is with his animal nature. Although it be true that the longer he has been without food, the more hungry he is, or the greater and more urgent is his desire of food, yet the more ignorant a man is, not the greater, but generally speaking, the less is his desire of knowledge. And this converse proposition is still more manifestly true of his moral than of his intellectual wants. The more immersed a man is in vice or in voluptuousness, not most certainly the greater, but beyond all doubt the less, is his desire of virtue or his desire of holiness. There is no natural hungering or thirsting after righteousness, and before man will seek that the want should be supplied, the appetite must first be created. The less a man has, whether of religion or righteousness, the less does he care for them, and the less will he seek after them. It is thus that nature does not go forth in quest of Christianity, but Christianity must go forth in quest of nature. It is, on the one hand, the strength of the physical appetency, and, on the other hand, the languor of the spiritual, the moral, or the intellectual appetency, which makes all the difference. The law of our moral and intellectual is not the same, but reverse or contrary to the law of our physical wants. With the physical, the intensity of the desire is directly proportional to the want. With the intellectual and moral, it is inversely proportional, or the less he has of these, the less he cares for them. The strength of man's natural craving guarantees an effectual demand for food or raiment, or all that might contribute to the shelter and convenience of the house that is over his head, which, rather than want, he will go, if he can, to the most distant market, and with the full price in his hand for them. But though we may trust to his natural longing for the goods which are to be had in a market, there is no such natural or universal longing for the good to be had in a church, or in a college, or even in a school. And never, therefore, was there a more unfortunate generalization than that by which our economists have placed on the same footing the articles of ordinary merchandise with the articles, whether of common or Christian education, or by which, because they have demonstrated of bounties for the one that they were unnecessary or even mischievous, they therefore contended against endowments for the other, as being, in their opinion, alike mischievous or alike unnecessary. These principles are in full accordance with the facts, both of past history and of present experience. With many there is a confused imagination that, previous to the establishment of Christianity, the whole ministry of the gospel was conducted on the system of free trade. On a closer view, however, and a proper discrimination of the things which differ, it will be found that what actually took place was the very reverse of this. It is true that in all ages the lessons of the gospel behooved to be paid for by someone, because the teachers of the gospel behooved to be maintained. But the whole system hinges upon this: who paid for these lessons? We know by whom it is that in the exchanges of ordinary business and on the principles of free trade the payments are usually made. They are the customers or users of the commodity that is purchased, who, generally speaking, pay its price and its whole price. It were in violation of the system of free trade if government paid any part of that price in the shape of a bounty. And it were an equal violation of the same system, from whatever quarter that bounty should come, whether from the state or from any body of associated philanthropists, or from private individuals. It is the doctrine, and we hold it a sound one, of the economists, that an article should no longer be brought to market if the price which purchasers are willing to pay for it do not remunerate the cost of its preparation, or if, to help out that price, advances must be made by any party distinct from the purchasers themselves. For in this case it were a losing trade, and so much of the capital of the country, it is argued, would be thrown away on a profitless or hurtful investment. And one of the foremost articles in our modern and, as we think, enlightened creed is that the supply of all those goods should cease for which there is not an effective demand that would cover the whole expense of bringing them to market, that the whole matter of demand and supply, in fact, should be left to find its own adjustment in the free choice of the two parties concerned in it, or should be made to hinge exclusively on the price which the one party are willing to give and the profit which the other party are willing to receive. Let these two elements act and react at will on each other, and so as to make out between them a self-going mechanism that would only be put out of order, as if by the violence of a disturbing force, should the intervention of any third party be admitted for the purpose either of help or of hindrance. In other words, The economists contend, and with our entire acquiescence, for the establishment of a perfect freedom in the world of trade as being the condition of things in which the best and most beneficial result, the greatest good or maximum of commercial prosperity, is realized, when dealers on the one hand are most profited and customers on the other are most pleased. Now, let us consider whether this is the footing on which the world ever is or ever can be supplied with its Christianity, or rather with its Christian instruction, in the way that is best for the moral interests of our species. It was not so at the first introduction of Christianity, in virtue, not of a movement from earth to heaven, but of a movement from heaven to earth, and the expenses of which, throughout the infancy and boyhood of the Savior, were certainly not defrayed by those for whose welfare the mission was undertaken. It was not so during the time of his public ministry, when 3 or 4 women ministered to him of their substance, as he traveled from place to place over the land of Judea. And so he was maintained at the cost of the few for the benefit of the many. It was not so in the journeyings of his disciples, 2 by 2, among their countrymen, who, when they entered a city, fixed their residence in some particular house, and were supported by the hospitality of one individual for the good of the general population. It was not so when the apostles went forth after the resurrection, and received their maintenance from such as Simon the tanner, or Lydia the seller of purple, or Stephanus and Fortunatus, and Achaicus, and others of those scripture worthies who harbored and entertained the men of God, while they held out the bread of life, without money and without price, to the multitude at large. It was not so when the last, but not the least of the apostles, provided with his own hand for his own necessities, and the wages of Paul the tentmaker enabled Paul the apostle to labor in a sacred vocation without wages. It was not so when he received from other and distinct churches that, in the church of Corinth, the gospel might not be chargeable to any, and he would suffer no man to strip him of this boasting in the regions of Achaia. And to come down from the age of the New Testament, it generally could not have been so that the extension of Christianity was carried forward during the first 3 centuries. The men who were not yet Christians did not, in those days, send to the apostolic college for men who might give them the lessons of the gospel, but by a reverse process, teachers went forth among the yet benighted countries of the earth, and their expenses, at least in the first instance, behooved to be borne, not in the shape of a price by those who received the benefit, but in the shape of a bounty by those who dispensed it. In all these instances, contrary to every law or character of pure trade, the expense was borne either totally or partially by one party, and that for the good of another party. It was not as in the ordinary exchanges of commerce. The receivers were not the purchasers, and what they did receive was not a thing by them bought, but a thing to them given. It is an utter misconception that when Constantine set up in his dominions a national establishment of Christianity, he made the first infringement on that system of free trade by which the prosperity of this religion had been heretofore upholden, for from its very outset Christianity stood indebted for almost every footstep of its progress to a system and a policy directly opposite of this. When he came forth with his great imperial bounty or benefaction, he only did on the large scale what thousands of benefactors had previously and for hundreds of years done on a small scale before him. when he became the friend and nursing father of the church, he did for the whole territory of which he was the sovereign, what, times and ways without number, the friends of the church had already done, each for the little district in which he himself resided, or for the introduction and the maintenance of Christian worship in some chosen locality of his own. With his great national endowment, he but followed in the track of those private and particular endowments, which, sometimes temporary and sometimes perpetual, had multiplied beyond all reckoning during the preceding ages of Christianity, and in virtue of which it was that churches innumerable were raised and congregations were formed, but chiefly in the large and flourishing cities of the Roman Empire. The peasants, or they who lived in the country and villages, inhabitants of the pagi, and hence called pagans, were, in the great bulk of them, still unconverted, insomuch that paganism in those days became synonymous with heathenism. Or, in other words, the great majority of the rustics or countrymen of that period, notwithstanding the strenuous and apostolic exertion of many thousands of Christian missionaries for about 3 centuries together, were still adherents to the old superstition and idolatry of their forefathers. The universal endowment, by which a ministry was provided for every little section of the territory, or the whole was broken into parishes, opened a way to the moral fastnesses that were still held and occupied by the countless millions whom all the efforts of bygone generations had not reached, and so brought a whole host of gospel laborers into contact with the wide and plenteous harvest of the general population. But, instead of looking to the distant past, of which the history is far from perfect, the same lesson might be drawn from the observation of present or modern times. Certain it is that the introduction of Christianity into any new land proceeds by a very different method from the introduction thereinto of any of the goods of ordinary merchandise. The commercial adventurers look for the remuneration of their expenses to the price or equivalent given by the natives themselves. The missionary adventurers are upheld in their expenses not by a price, but generally in the whole and almost always in part by a bounty, the bounty of those who employ and send them forth in full equipment for their high enterprise of charity. In this process, that law of equal and reciprocal barter between them who bestow and them who receive the benefit, which the advocates of a free trade contend for, is altogether unknown. Rather than want the teas of China, the families of Britain do, in effect, send for them along half the circumference of the globe and defray the whole cost of the expensive and distant voyage by which they are brought to our shores. But who paid for the outfit and all the other charges of that first missionary vessel, which first wafted the gospel to the remote island of Otaheite? Not the natives themselves, who should have wanted the blessings of Christianity forever, had we waited for their effective demand, or not moved but in the expectation of a safe and profitable return from their hands for the cost of this great undertaking. The undertaking originated with us, and was defrayed to the last farthing out of a missionary fund raised from the benevolent of our own land. It is generally thus that all missionary work is upholden, paid and provided for, not by the receivers of Christianity, but by its dispensers, or rather by those who maintain the dispensers. So that, at least in the extension of Christianity, we do not sell the gospel, but offer it. We do not calculate on a price, as in the operations of commerce, but have recourse to a bounty, that dread and deprecation of all the economists, without which, whatever the effect might be on the continuance of Christianity in old countries, the propagation of it, at least in new countries, were altogether hopeless. Some may contend that, on the principles of free trade, Christianity could be perpetuated wherever it is already planted, but few will have the hardihood to affirm that, on these principles, its first settlement could have been effected in any land. But though Christianity were indebted to the operation of a bounty for every footstep of its progress from one region to another, this is far from being decisive of the controversy. For properly the question relates not to the methods by which Christianity is introduced, but to the methods by which it might be maintained in any land. It might be very true that the taste, and consequently the demand, for this religion must first be created among those people to whom it is at present unknown, and that therefore, anterior to this, instead of waiting till it be sought after, it must be offered to their acceptance, or be carried to their doors and taught to their families, not at their own expense, but at the expense of others beside themselves. It is even thus that commerce sometimes obtains a footing for itself in particular countries. Before the natives can have a liking for certain of its articles, they must first have a sight and a trial of them. And so instances can be given where dealers have adventured their goods into places where, instead of finding a market, they had first to form one at their own hazard, therefore, or even expense in the first instance, and not at the expense of customers. But though it was thus at the commencement of the trade, it could not possibly be thus that we can explain the continuance of the trade. The same people who would not send for the commodity at the first might, when once made to know and to relish it, rather than want, be abundantly willing to pay for it afterwards. And might not Christianity be sped in like manner? Though introduced at the expense of others, might it not, when the appetite for its lessons is excited, be maintained by themselves afterwards, and that not by certain of the nation for the benefit of the rest, but entirely and exclusively by those who receive the benefit? It might be very true that missionaries, at the charge and bidding of those who are Christians, must be employed for the conversion of those who are not Christians, but may it not also be true that after their conversion has been effected, then a native demand will be set a-going, and ministers be employed at their own charge and their own bidding for keeping up this religion from generation to generation? There is a great semblance of probability for this, in much that might be seen both throughout our own land and in various countries of Christendom. In Britain, there are many hundreds of large and flourishing congregations where all the expenses of the service are defrayed by the hearers themselves. These are pure instances of free trade and of an interchange as complete and equal as any which ever takes place between the buyers and the sellers of a market, where Christian instruction is rendered by the one party and where its price, its whole price, is rendered by the other party, where there is not one farthing of endowment to help out the maintenance of the clergyman, and a remuneration for his labor, often adequate and respectable, is fully made good to him by those who enjoy the fruits of it. This operation of demand and supply is often exemplified both within and without the Church of England in many a successful chapel and many a prosperous meeting house, where, in virtue of a large or a wealthy attendance, the produce of the seat rents is sufficient both for the payment of the minister and for all the other expenses of the concern. And, most assuredly, we have no quarrel with institutes like these, provided only that a pure gospel is delivered and that Christian good is done by them. In whatever way Christ is faithfully and efficiently preached, it is the part of every honest disciple therein to rejoice. And no one can question the undoubted contributions made to the cause of religion in the proprietary chapels of such churchmen as Newton and Cecil and Howell and Daniel Wilson, or of such dissenters as Watts and Doddridge and Andrew Fuller and Robert Hall. But it follows not that, because there is a fitness in such as these to supplement the establishment, there is also a sufficiency in them to supersede the establishment, or that the economy which is found to succeed within the limits of many a select and separate assemblage of worshippers is the proper type of that larger economy, the object of which is to extend the blessings of Christian knowledge over the whole length and breadth of a land. And, on viewing more specifically and attentively the state of these unendowed chapels, it will be found that on the strict principles of a reciprocal trade, a very large proportion of them could not possibly be sustained. In very many instances, the seat rents of the occupiers, aided even by their voluntary offerings, are inadequate to the yearly expenses of the undertaking. And so subscriptions have to be instituted which are carried beyond the hearers themselves. Or collections are advertised for the benefit of the chapel funds to which the public at large are invited. Or creditors, whether by constraint or generosity, have to transmute their loan into a gift by the abandonment of their claims altogether. Or journeys have to be undertaken that money might be raised in various ways to help on the building of chapels in progress, or to extricate those already built from their sore embarrassments. And the innumerable other shifts and difficulties of these heavily indebted concerns, familiar to those who are vested with the management, all serve to demonstrate that, unlike to the other articles which are brought into a market and of which the supply is continued only because of an adequately remunerating price, unlike to these, the returns for the articles of Christian instruction are very often beneath the prime cost incurred in the preparation of it. In thousands of instances, we might venture to say, the inadequacy of the whole sum obtained from the seat rents must be made up by a liberality or a bounty obtained from other quarters. Or, which is the same thing, they who receive the whole benefit of the ministration do not pay the whole price of it, and the deficiency is covered by certain others who have no share in the benefit. In this transaction between the minister and his people, what is given on the one hand and what is received on the other do not stand to each other as the equivalents of a mercantile exchange. The payment for his services consists of two ingredients, one in the character of a price, but the other in the character of a present, which, coming from the hands of individuals, might be termed a benevolence, would be termed an endowment, did it come from the hands of the state. But the strongest argument remains behind for the necessity either of such a benevolence being raised from the Christian public or of such an endowment being obtained from the state. We may find, though a very few of those wealthy congregations, which in virtue of a revenue made up of golden seat rents can support their clergymen in affluence, and of course the highest in the scale, as may be seen at a glance on the face of the assemblage within, or as may be collected at the proper hour by the passing traveller without, from the throng and splendour of the many vehicles which beset the chapel doors. And descending from such, there may perhaps be some hundreds more of independent or self-subsisting congregations in our land, which at the end of the year can exhibit their favorable balance and be appealed to as so many examples of the prosperous working of the system of free trade in Christianity, where wealthy merchants, even substantial tradesmen, and at times, though rarely, a certain but small proportion of the best conditioned among the working classes in the cheapest or outskirt pews, make up a body of worshippers of whom it may justly be said that they pay to the full and without help from any foreign quarter for the spiritual provision both of themselves and of their families. Over and above these, we have as many thousands of those places of worship which, but for the aid, either of private or public benevolence, would have turned out to be so many failures, indebted for their perpetuity to helps which are perfectly honorable to both parties, but which, as being departures from the system of free trade, serve at least to demonstrate its insufficiency for the supply of any land with the lessons of the gospel. And accordingly, we find that in such congregations, it falls short of maintaining them. And that because congregations of altogether a more plebeian cast and composition than those which we have just specified, planted, it may be, in some poorer districts of the country, or admitting, if in town, a larger proportion of artisans and laborers. The system of free trade does something for these congregations, but does not and cannot do all. It should be accredited with the sum of all the prices fetched in the shape of seat rents from those who are hearers, but these, in violation of that free trade system which repudiates all bounties, have to be supplemented by presents fetched from those who are not hearers. These, therefore, are not specimens of the sufficiency of the system. The difficulties under which they labor, their struggles to keep themselves afloat, the many shifts and difficulties which they must resort to, in the shape of drafts on the charity, both of individuals and of the public, may all be appealed to as evidences that, however commerce may thrive, on the native power of her own articles to summon the attendance of customers and call forth a full equivalent at their hands, it is not thus that Christianity can be so sped and carried forward, or can ever become commensurate to the whole length and breadth of a country's population. But, as we have already said, the strongest argument of all remains behind. We have accompanied the progress of these unendowed chapels so far down in the scale of society, and have found, in the greatest majority of those which we have come to last, that on the mere footing of a commercial speculation they could not be upholden. They in all probability would never have been built but for the prospect of an addition from some other source than the market price of sittings. And certain it is that without such addition they would never have been maintained. When thus pushed to their extreme limit, and then examined as to the rank and quality of those who repair to them, it will be found that they serve chiefly for the accommodation of those who may be designated the lower of the middle class. And these mingled, to a certain extent, with household servants, and the better conditioned of the working classes in society. But the decisive fact is that beyond this limit, across which our chapel undertakers have never ventured, and that because from the ulterior on the other side of it there is the certainty of a dead loss to scare them away, on this untrodden vastness, there do exist thousands and thousands more, comprising often the great mass and majority of the common people, whom a deficient establishment on the one hand has necessarily left out, and whom all the energies of dissent upon the other, with all which the system of free trade can do, and all which Christian benevolence does into the bargain, have not overtaken. They cannot, it would appear, be allured as customers into those houses which dissenters have provided. And there are no houses provided by the establishment to take them in as commoners, and that because the establishment has fallen short of its proper design, which is to hold forth Christianity without charge to the poor, or as a common good and benefit for all the families of all the population. And so it will be found that in the surplus territory, whether it be met with in town or country, the great bulk and body of our ordinary workmen are neither churchgoers nor chapelgoers. It is a question of statistics and admits of being determined arithmetically and experimentally. Our assertion is borne out by every ecclesiastical survey that has been made in those places where the church is greatly short of the population and where the free trade system has put forth all its energies to supplement the deficiency. And accordingly, there are 80,000 human beings in Glasgow who should be the regular attendants on divine worship and who yet go regularly and habitually nowhere. And 50,000 in Edinburgh, and at the very least 500,000 in London, and untold myriads in the manufacturing districts of Yorkshire and Lancashire. The thing admits of being brought decisively to the test of observation. It is at the choice of any single inquirer to verify it on his own account. Let him go forth on any district, whether of town or country, if the same or similarly conditioned with the places which we have now specified, and it be chiefly inhabited by men of handicraft and hard labor, let him fix at random on some contiguous thousand of a population made up of such materials, and he will often find that where at least one half should be every Sabbath in the house of God, not 100 or a tenth of the whole, much oftener, not 125 or 1/8 of the whole, very seldom indeed 150 or between a sixth and seventh of the whole, that have sittings in any place of worship, whether in the parish church or in meeting houses of all denominations. On the field of his investigation, the population may have doubled or tripled, or perhaps even be assembled on a territory where, within its limits a century before, there was not a single human habitation. It is most interesting to know what free trade does and what it leaves undone in such new and increasing settlements as these. And it will invariably be found that while shops and markets and the number of victuallers and clothiers keep full pace with the increasing population and their increasing demand for food and raiment, the churches and the chapels, even the schools, and of course, the number of teachers, whether for religion or learning, have notoriously fallen short and not kept pace with them. The dealers in those things which are necessary to life ever maintain an equal proportion with the growing number of the families. The dealers in those things which are necessary to godliness fall behind this proportion, very often to 1/5, not unfrequently to 1/10, sometimes so low or even lower than 1/20, leaving a vast moral wilderness in all those places where the people have been left to multiply and at the same time left to themselves. Dealers, of course, accommodate their wares to the taste and inclination of their customers. And it were a transgression on the principle and philosophy of free trade to interfere with this process. And true it is that to its single operation may be confided with all safety the supply of the physical wants of our nature. Let a bazaar be instituted for the sale of provisions, and at the powerful and ever-recurring call of hunger, the multitude with one accord will flock daily to its portals, and with such a price in their hands too as will remunerate all the expenses of the establishment. Let the institute be a church for distribution amongst them of the bread of life, or for the supply of their moral and religious wants, and its presence in the midst of them, with the weekly invitations of its Sabbath bell, will fail to attract beyond the veriest handful of the surrounding population to this house of prayer, and more especially if the market price for the accommodation and the service be expected at their hands. It may or it may not be filled to an overflow by hearers from all distances, who have both the wealth and the will to pay for their attendance. But hundreds often are the families in the precincts of this temple of piety, so near that the voice of its psalms may enter their dwellings, yet not awaken them from the insensibility of their spiritual death. In the midst of besetting opportunities do they abide in their fastnesses, and just because left, as the system of free trade leaves everyone, to their own inclinations, are there thousands, nay, millions in our land, who, abandoned to themselves and voluntary aliens from the light of the gospel, are left to live in guilt and die in grossest darkness. Such is the melancholy upshot of those rash and unfortunate generalizations which the philosopher often indulges in his closet, and which have sometimes, to the great curse of the nation on whom they are inflicted, found their way into the cabinet and been carried into effect by those vain and misguided statesmen who, themselves the erring worshippers of science and ambitious of its honors, have drunk, but not deeply, at the Pierian spring. It may be well in commerce that markets should be left to find their own spontaneous level, and that the two elements of demand and supply should be suffered, without interference, to come to their own mutual adjustment of themselves. But it is not well that matter should be thus left in Christianity, else no attempt will be made either to instruct the poor or to reclaim the profligate. And men, left to their own native indifference in spiritual things, will lapse into a habit of irreligion, will rather never be raised or liberated therefrom. The benefits which commerce confers upon the world are all provided at the expense, not of the dispensers, but of the recipients. Let this be the footing on which the benefits of Christianity are provided also, and in what possible way shall we reach either the depraved or the destitute? Those who have no will for its moral and spiritual blessings, or those who have no wealth to purchase them? In truth, there is no enlightened philanthropist bent on the highest interests of humanity, and no enlightened patriot or statesman bent on the chief good of his own land, who would not prize it as a most gainful as well as glorious achievement, if the great bulk of the people in these realms would but consent to take the lessons of Christianity for nothing, and be taught in the doctrine and morality of the gospel at the expense of others, and without one farthing of the purchase money being advanced by themselves. This sacred theme, the education of the people, more especially when the education of principle, has been utterly vulgarized by the computations of a cold and secular utilitarianism. Never was there a wider departure from all principle and truth than when proposed to liken this highest good of the community to the goods of ordinary merchandise. Whether viewed as an error of speculation by the savant, or as the crude imagination of the prosperous citizen, who appeals to the snug prosperity of his own thriving chapel, which, because filled to the door by wealthy seat-payers like himself, he would therefore hold forth as the representative and type of that system by which the religion of a whole country should be provided for. The best and greatest interests of human society must not be so trifled with. And after all, there is not only false sentiment, but even false arithmetic, in the view of these gross and mercantile calculators. The universal scholarship for which we are contending would, if carried into effect, be indeed the cheapest defense of our nation, whether its expenses shall be defrayed in the form of a liberality by the hands of private individuals, or from the public treasury in the form of an endowment. We have not yet, however, made good the conclusion that a national establishment is the best and fittest expedient for providing our general population with the lessons of Christianity, although we trust it may now appear that it is not on the free trade principle, which is the principle of let alone, that we can most effectually secure this high interest. We may have scored off this from the list of expedients. Yet other expedients for the religious education of the people may remain to be disposed of, besides that of an establishment. And, having now delivered our views on the scheme of the economists, we shall proceed in our next lecture to expound and to give our estimate of another scheme, which, though generally held to be identical with the former, is in some material respects distinct from it. We mean the scheme of the voluntaries. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit westportexperiment.com for more audio resources and where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.